Accession number 30062, Reel 6.
Len Reynolds, Reel 6. So the speed of the convoy was going to be 10 knots?
Yes, we're at 10 knots. But in case anything went wrong, and we needed, and we were beginning to run out of petrol, we had another 3,000 gallons of petrol on the upper deck in tanks specially bolted on, which were both heavy and made the old boat lumbering all the time and made access to everything impossible. You know, you had to climb over, there were ladders and things to get round the deck.
So what was it like moving around?
Oh, it was awful. But it only lasted just for the week of going out there, really. And also, of course, there was danger from them with 100-octane petrol. And the last thing was that... No, the guns that were close to the petrol tanks had to be prevented from being able to fire so that they could ever fire into the tanks. So you had interrupter rails that the barrel of the gun would hit. So in other words, you just prayed that you'd never have to use them on the way to Gib. And we set out on, I think it was about the 20th, must have been just into April, yes, because we'd only commissioned on the 26th. It must have been about a week or 10 days. No, a bit more than that, because Pembroke Dock we were hanging around for quite a week or so. And we tried to do some training with the crew all the time, but it wasn't very easy to do it. And that bit of the coast of Wales has an enormous rise and fall. And, you know, you had to be careful to let your lines, just as you do in a lock. Have you ever been in a narrowboat on the canals?
No.
Just along there?
Yeah.
Is it Bolter's Lock? And,
of course, yeah.
It was all very difficult anyway. And then the word was given for the off, and we knew we were going to go right out into the Atlantic, because the U-boat packs at this time were at their maximum that they were going to be. We never knew this, of course, that they'd been getting more and more successful in their sinkings, the U-boat packs from Brest and Lorient. And we were told that to avoid them, if possible, we've got to go out to 13 West, which is quite a long way, and well beyond the coast of Ireland, and right out into the Atlantic. And the weather was foul. This was equinoctial period, really, and always is unsettled. And we had to go all this way westward first, and then go due south down to more or less outside the curve of Spain, and then ready to go eastward into Gib. And that made 1,000 miles. And, there was an exciting incident, because a U-boat pack, we learned a lot about this afterwards, but we know what happened then, but we didn't know why it happened or anything else.
Tell me what happened then,
right,
to start with.
Okay. Well, it was about 4 days out, and we were going on the southern stretch, out at 13 West, going down the longitude line, and going south, and suddenly, pitch black, we could only ever keep station by a little blue light on the stern of the boat ahead, which was permitted, because it couldn't be seen at all from forward. And suddenly, from this pitch black, came a stream of tracer, which hit the first boat in the line, which was the senior of the three Canadians. He was at the front of the line, and it hit one of his upper deck petrol tanks. Corney, who was on watch with me, I didn't serve a watch on my own because I was too inexperienced, but I served the watches with him, and then Pick, who was quite experienced, did the next watch, and then I would come on with Corney again. And Corney immediately said, "Punt the buzzer for action stations." And of course, they were only just beginning to know what action stations were. But they all tumbled up on deck, bleary-eyed, half sick, and he went straight for where the tracer had come from. We couldn't see a thing. But obviously it was a U-boat, it couldn't be anything else, and on the surface. So he immediately said to the pom-pom, the only one firing straight forward, which was a good strong gun, "Fire in that direction." We didn't. By then the tracer had finished, and we went tearing down the line of this tracer, and didn't see a thing, couldn't see a thing, no signs of anything, and obviously it had submerged again. That's all we knew. Doug's boat, the one had been hit, he could have had a really nasty situation because his tank was on fire, and he turned into the wind, and sea came over the bow and put the fire out. The marvellous bit of seamanship on his part. And nobody else had been hit at all. And the people on the far side of the convoy, nearly a mile away, knew nothing about it at all, except perhaps a sharp-eyed lookout might have seen a flash of tracer, but not much more, and a bit of firing from us. Well, we went round in a great big circle and to come back up the line. But really, we couldn't see anyone. We couldn't be sure exactly how. But when it was morning, there was the convoy, a bit ahead of us and a bit beyond us, so we all joined up. And Doug said, "Yes, I put my fire out, so we're all right. Nobody, I think one slightly wounded, but nothing else." And so on we soldiered southward again, and began to get nicer weather. And by the way, the two motor mechanics, not having been able to stay on their feet, the one thing they became able to do was to get the generator working, which hadn't worked for the first 3 days of the time, and therefore we had no hot water and no food, hot, and we lived on tinned pineapple, tinned peaches, and shredded wheat, and that sort of thing. Nothing else, really, and odd tins of meat and stuff that couldn't be cooked. So, at last, we had a generator, and we all began to shave again. I was shaving by the time. And we knew nothing else what had happened until we turned east and getting Gibraltar in sight, and the old trawler in front of us was giving the orders for the whole group. And Derek and I were vying with each other. He was the boat astern of us. We were vying to read all the signals as they were given, and we read "Brig for entering Gibraltar Harbour, half whites, half blues," which was a change because we'd never seen whites before. And that's a particular rig. "Prisoners will be met by escort." That's all we knew. And we checked with each other and got that right. By semaphore we did that. And then when we got in, we realised that the MTBs in the far column had been soldiering along, not knowing really anything had been going on at all, you know. And they'd been soldiering along, and suddenly, ahead of them in the water, were people swimming about with lights on. This was way out in the Atlantic, with their, some lights clipped onto life jackets. And they pulled on to the first two boats. Altogether, I think, seven men. And it turned out they were from two different U-boats. Now, what we learned afterwards was that two U-boat packs were dispatched by the Führer de U-boats from Brest, one to attack the convoy of MTBs, which had already been reported by a reconnaissance aircraft flying over us, much too high. We all fired at them, but couldn't hope to touch them. And one to a convoy, was dispatched to a convoy of landing craft about 50 miles south of us, ahead of us. And we've got the German report now, you see, and in the latest edition of the book, I give this story as we eventually knew it was. The lot dispatched to attack us was the lot that actually the leader said, I'm going to go up to periscope depth and see if we can spot them, and then I'll go to the surface and I'll open fire and see what happens. But he obviously did that and then submerged again. He didn't think that he was in a particularly good position, I expect. Meanwhile, the U-boat pack, which had been sent south to the landing craft convoy, didn't find them. And when he saw things happening to the north, he came up to join them, the other pack. And it seems that they weren't in touch with each other, and they weren't in a good lookout, but they both, the leading boat with the senior officers of each flotilla, U-boat pack, they collided with each other and they both sank. And these few people managed to get away, and they were the ones that were picked up. The nice human story is that one of the chaps was the ship's cook and baker, the U-boats, and he cooked for the rest of the journey for the MGB.
So they had good meals.
And they weren't all that. And they all seemed nice chaps, and they looked after them, and there was no problem about that. And they landed them at Gibraltar. And of course, it was lovely to get there and get on dry land again and have a decent shower and bath and all the rest of it ashore. And I can't remember a lot of going ashore and seeing bronzed people, all the sailors were in whites and all the rest of it, and see bananas in the shops, and everything was, you know, so different from dear old England, which was suffering so much at the time. So it was a new life, and they told us they were going to send us on as fast as they could. So they ripped off the upper deck tanks, and they removed the interrupter rails from the guns, and so on. And we left the next day to go to Algiers.
I'm just wondering whether this might be actually a good place to
break.
To break, yeah. Stop.
questions because that's up. Len Reynolds, reel 7. Again. So, we were talking last time. You got to Gibraltar, and that's where we'd paused, and we were going to start off by talking about the crew.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was a big thing to receive a crew from the beginning, just before we commissioned. They arrived there, the coxswain had mustered them, and they'd all been drafted down to Brixham, and he produced them, and he said to the captain, he said, "I haven't got a crew, I've got a workforce." He said, "I've now got to train them into being a crew." And the reason for that was that there were 32 men. Most of them had come from training, really, with hardly been to sea, except for 5 or 6 who were regular Navy. So, in fact, the coxswain was a Welshman, and about 30, the old man of the crew. But he was extremely good, a good seaman and a good psychologist, and he could work, get the right relationship. He had to be stern because he had raw material to knock into naval shape, as it were, but he had to get their respect and then train them. He had, and there were two petty officers who were both engine room crew. But so he obviously didn't have much to do with the engine room crew. There were 2 motor mechanics who'd never been to sea before, and that was a huge problem to us very quickly. And there were 4 stokers, one of whom was a leading stoker. So that was that then, and they slept and lived down aft in a cabin, which was the stoker's mess, and then alongside it was the petty officer's mess. Up forward, as we all say, was a mess deck. It composed of really the whole shape of the bowels of the boat, and in there 17 or so sailors lived under a leading seaman who was a great chap. He was also very experienced, but he was only about, 22, probably 23, and one of the old men of the crew, you see. And I think 3 seamen, one of whom was the electrician. Very soon they began to show their characters. I could tell straight away who were going to be a problem, of being lazy or being likely to break the rules and so on. But the captain, Corney, as we've talked about him already, had created these wonderful, the orders of standing orders, and they were all displayed for them to read, learn, and inwardly digest, and they were all he rubbed their noses in it, really. Caught a lot with minor punishments early on, and they soon learned to get to know their way. The characters, there was one cockney, a marvellous youngster called Arthur Francis, and Alfie Tanner was his sidekick. They're both from London. And there's one marvellous example, which I'll say now, because it shows his character. We'd been doing, a little later, just before the invasion of Sicily, we'd been reading, telling them exactly what was going to happen and how secret it was, and the orders were burned before reading, and that we weren't going to allow any shore leave before we went at all, so that they couldn't go and say anything. And he said, at the end of all this, and Corney had absolutely drummed into them this is where they were going to get started, and they'd really have to know their way about. And Arthur Francis, he said, piped up at the end. Corney said, any questions? And he said, do you think we'll get any shore leave in Sicily, sir? With which a very interesting cut the whole thing off beautifully. But anyway, there they were, and we'll refer to others. And there were a couple of older, slightly older, not very much older, but also from training. Corney had already had just had time to take them to a firing range. Did I tell you about
that? We did, yes, we talked about that. Yeah.
And he decided who was going to be the captain of each gun, because he wanted the people who had a natural ability to shoot straight, and that worked marvellously. So there's the crew.
There's the crew.
Three officers we've talked about already. Me, the learning chap, green as grass, really, although I'd been a sailor for 6 months at sea and a year altogether. But I really didn't know anything. A good example is that all the way out from into the Med, across the Bay of Biscay and down to Spain, I'd worn my best uniform for some of that time, which was absolutely ridiculous and something I'd never did again.
What should you have been wearing?
Oh, any old scruffy stuff with a sweater. It didn't matter when you were at sea. You weren't trying to, except perhaps when you were mustering the crew, you put your uniform on for that if you had a duty to do. But anyway, we were going to set out towards where the action was, or had just been. If you remember, I said that we were trying to get to the Med very fast because we needed to get to Tunisia, where the battle was ending. But we'd missed that, but the object was still to get down there so that we were poised ready wherever we needed to go. And our first objective, we'd been told in Gibraltar, was to get to a small port in, I think probably just in Algiers, or nearly on the border with Tunisia, called Bone, where there was an advanced coastal force base. And that had been formed just before. The new CO of the base was a commander, RNVR, which was a very unusual animal. In fact, you hardly ever saw a commander, RNVR. And there were only two or three captains in the whole of the Navy, RNVR, because to do that you had to have been in the RNVR before the war and already to have proved ability. And this marvellous chap that we all adored, really, I must say, he was a most charismatic character and extremely forcible. He'd been chosen after being the senior officer of a flotilla of short boats, some of the early boats that had come out down at the end of the Mediterranean, and he'd been down there.
Can you remind me of his name?
Bobby Allen, Commander Robert Allen, who later, incidentally, became Lord Allen, and who'd been Treasurer of the Conservative Party, and he'd been at Harrow, and after the war he was, I think, Chairman of Governors of Harrow. So he was character, really, with due for many things.
I wondered, what was it about him that was so charismatic?
Breeding, I think. And, yes, more than anything that. And just general likeable character and the strength of personality that you see in a man that knows where he's going and how he wants this advanced base, which was a new concept, to work, the way he gathered it together with lorries purloined from probably may well have been German lorries and all sorts,
And these lorries were workshops with lathes and things in them, so that his men, the engineers, the, or at least the motor mechanics and fitters and all the rest of it, could work. And he had to work well with the local people, and he had Arabs working in having to work for us. And you always learn never to leave anything anywhere, otherwise the goddamned Arabs were likely to get it. So that was it. So we knew we were going down there. First was we did pop into a little port called Bougie, where one of the boats had got a minor problem with its engines, so the whole group of us, and we were in fact the boats of the 20th MGB flotilla, who'd arrived in that first convoy, and there were I think four going together down to Bougie, and then moved on straight to Algiers. And Algiers was the night when we had a huge air raid, and it was pretty awful because there were many large ships there, some of whom decided that they would be firing at the aircraft with larger guns than we could manage. The rule was that you didn't fire, generally, because you couldn't see a thing. And we couldn't see a thing largely because there were smoke pots sending up a ghastly acrid smoke and covering the whole port like that. But we were only there a night. I think it was only one. I remember just being allowed a couple of hours to go and see what an Arab market, a souk, looked like, you know.
What did it look like?
I can't really remember. But, it's different entirely because everyone was dressed in these white flowing garments, you know, and it was a new... I was looking at it all through the eyes of someone lapping up new things all the time, and fascinated. But you couldn't have at that time an inquiring mind, because you were only going to be there one night, and there was something else to do on board. And then we went on to Bone, and we were there, I suppose, about 3 weeks. In that time, we were all doing the normal things that you do if you're not operating in an area where you could operate, actually, to go to seek and destroy. If you're preparing to begin to seek and destroy, I would work, the navigator would naturally work on his charts and with corrections where minefields were and things which were pushed out by the Admiralty. Incidentally, the crew always referred to the Admiralty as the Admiralty. It was it was lovely, but you didn't mind that at all. And there was always very often an adjective in front of the Admiralty, because there were many things like pay. And but mind you, they didn't know enough, our crew on the whole, to be a Bolshe in any way, to start with, anyway.
No, they could learn that one.
Yes.